Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Katie Lederer lived the hedge fund life in the thick of a dazzling bubble. She was there for 6 years as the billions flew and grew. She made her own chunk of change, but at heart, she was a writer, a poet, and found poetry in and around the world of high finance. That's rare. It got us thinking about literature and money now that a lot of the money is gone. This hour, On Point, Katie Lederer, hedge fund poet and the sensitive soul in the ruins of high finance. You can join the conversation. Masters of the Universe, did you find poetry in the bubble, in the billions? And what do we learn when we open the books on money? Joining me now from Atlanta is Katie Lederer. She grew up the daughter of a prep school English teacher. But the money bug runs deep in the family. Her brother and sister are two of the world's top professional poker players. For the last 6 years, until Labor Day, Katie worked in New York for D.E. Shaw, one of the world's biggest hedge funds, billions under management. She was a VP. Her new book of poetry is The Heaven-Sent Leaf. Katie Lederer, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us this hour from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly. He's also author of Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900, and Colossus, How the Corporation Changed America. He's thought a little bit about money. Jack, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad you said I thought about money. I haven't made any of it, but I've thought a good deal. Hello, Katie. Nice to have you on the program.
I'm excited to be on the show with you.
Hey, it's great to have you both. A hedge fund poet. We just love that handle, Katie. Is that how you thought of yourself? What were you doing?
No.
You were at the hedge fund. You were a vice president at D.E. Shaw. That's the same hedge fund that Larry Summers works for. I mean, this is the big time.
That's true.
$30, $40 billion at they wing around the world. What were you doing there?
I did a lot of jobs there, but my last job was basically running their front office recruiting, which means the people who kind of are near the markets, near the money. So it'd be traders, analysts, quantitative analysts, who
quantitative.
I adored. I loved recruiting them, and programmers, computer programmers.
A poet who loved recruiting quantitative analysts for a hedge fund. What was the magic in recruiting? These are math whizzes, right, who sort of do all the wild calculations to figure out how hedge funds can ideally make money when nobody else is. What's the magic in recruiting quantitative analysts for a hedge fund, O Poetess?
But one thing that was really great about working at a quantitative hedge fund and working in that area in particular is that the candidates I was dealing with were just very intelligent. They tended to be math PhDs, people who maybe would have had an academic career, but for various reasons decided to go into finance. So I have an MFA in poetry and have a fairly academic background. So it really didn't feel that different. I mean, it's different. It's faster paced, and obviously you can see the consequences of some of what happens in trading firms is much different than what happens in academia. But the personalities were very academic, really lovely.
And how do you lure a quantitative analyst into a hedge fund? I mean, does the
strippers,
poetry...
Strippers, you take over the strip club. No.
we'll have to figure that out. I'm just looking here at The Heaven-Sent Leaf. It's your new collection. You got a lot of poems. And let me just read just a tiny bit, then we're going to have you. But this is from one called A Heavenly Body. And maybe when you're working at a hedge fund, script and cash and coin is on your mind. This one begins, "The earth is a dollar and the moon is a silvery coin, denomination indeterminate, its imprint rubbed to nearly gone. Let us free love this heavenly body as crafted and dumb as all minted desire." Hedge fund sounds like the very navel of minted desire in this world. Did it feel that way working there, that you were in the heart of material desire?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I'm a contrarian. And when I got there, obviously a lot of my poet friends were a little confused as to why I'd want to work in a place like that. And most people in society, and probably why I'm of interest to some media right now, is they associate, like, the things that happen in hedge funds or finance firms is with like greed or lasciviousness even, you know, it sort of veers into all sorts of sins, basically. But for me, I sort of felt like it was really on a sort of spectrum. So poets often write about like desire, let's say. Mm-hmm. But obviously that's sort of on a spectrum with greed. So I was interested in kind of where those two worlds actually met. So certainly the hedge fund world, I don't think everyone there is greedy by any means, but it presents sort of different versions of some of the classic tropes of poetry, you know, desire, longing, yearning, you know.
You wrote a whole book about playing poker with the family poker face. It was called A Girlhood Among Gamblers. And then you wrote, speaking of desire, you wrote a book of erotic poetry, Winter Sex.
Yes.
And now you're, at least for the moment, the hedge fund poet. Let's hear a little bit. Could you read for us, Katie, The Business, one of your poems?
Sure. Sure. Maybe just quickly to introduce this poem, mm-hmm. there's a sort of theme in the book of the writer, right? The writer sitting at a keyboard typing mm-hmm. and how that sort of from a distance would maybe look like someone in an office typing. The business. Let us stop this fraught analysis and get on with the business. To walk through pristine hallways and observe the little fingers go. They click and clack, they click and clack, the sad, smiling faces like clowns. The reason that a person would sit down as if to pray and then just type the mystic day away. These white walls, these blue windows in some weather gray. What this freedom, this river, this emerald green flow? Why are we laughing now? We can't let go. Why are we laughing now?
Katie Lederer reading The Business there from her new collection of poems, The Heaven Sent Leaf. And when I picture that, you coming out of hedge fund, the little fingers going click-clack, I'm thinking of a calculator or a BlackBerry and investing billions. It may be a writer you're thinking, but that emerald green flow sort of sounds, feels, looks like money to me, writing from that seat. Jack Beatty, what do you think of writing out of the heart of high finance, writing poetry out of the heart of high finance, Jack?
Well, you know, poetry transforms life into imagination, and money transforms imagination into life. And it's this property of money that led Karl Marx to, I think, a passage of poetry. He quoted in his philosophical manuscripts Shakespeare in Timon of Athens, who writes, "Gold will this yellow slave will knit and break religions, bless the accursed, make the whore leprosy adored, place thieves and give them title, knee, and approbation with senators on the bench. This is it that makes the wapened widow wed again." And Marx picks up what he calls money as the universal whore, the universal pimp of men and peoples. I am ugly, but I can buy the most beautiful woman, which means to say that I am not ugly. For the effect of ugliness, its repelling power is destroyed by money. As an individual, I am lame, but money procures me 24 legs. Consequently, I am not lame. I am a wicked, dishonest, unscrupulous, and stupid individual. But money is respected, and so also is its owner. Money is the highest good, and consequently, its owner is also good. Moreover, money spares me the trouble of being dishonest, and I am therefore presumed to be honest. I am mindless, but if money is the true mind of all things, how can its owner be mindless? What is more, he can buy clever people for himself, and is not he who has power over clever people cleverer than them? Through money, I can have anything the human heart desires.
Holy moly. Wow. Sit down and think about it right now. Let's get a call. Scott in Montpelier, Vermont. Scott, you're on the air with Jack Beatty and Katie Lederer.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Yeah. You know, it's difficult to to listen to poetry from somebody who's been in a hedge fund when, in fact, you know, we're on the brink of economic disaster in this country. And the short-term philosophy and greed of hedge funds is part of the reason. So
a lot of tension built into that listening, maybe, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's sort of difficult to listen to it. And this person sounds like a lovely person, and I'm sure she is. But, you know, the mission of the organization doesn't take into account the importance of long-term investment and the welfare of the American people and of this country. So I'm certainly disappointed in hedge funds and their philosophy and mission, and was wondering what especially our friend in Hanover has to say about that.
We'll get it all, Scott. Katie, let me come first to you. We've got a break coming up, but you can hear the teeth on edge there listening. And it's not only hedge funds and money you're writing about, granted, but I mean, this must be a response you run into often, given how it's all fallen down in particular.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'd say to that is I think it's very important that writers and artists sort of report, in the same way journalists report from different arenas in life. And for me, I think, you know, I'm excited about this book because I feel like, in a way, it's a form of anthropology. And, you know, if you read the book, the nice listener out there, you know, it's certainly an ambivalent book. I mean, money, I think, maybe to counter Jack a little bit, it's, you know, in literature, there are wonderful passages about sort of the negative, corrupting effects of money. But in the end, money, it's sort of, in a way, it's neutral. It's almost like water around fish, right? We're all participating in the economy and the money culture. Obviously, this financial crisis, certainly, you know, there have been some real bad guys. But people participated, right? Consumers took out lines of credit. People bought houses and...
It was as human as we are, but on quite a scale
human.
Where you were. Katie, please stand by in Atlanta. Katie yes. Lederer is here. She's the author of the new poetry collection, The Heaven Sent Leaf. Hedge fund poet, we're calling her today. Jack Beatty's here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
It's the root of all evil, of strife and upheaval, but I'm certain, honey, that life would be sunny.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with hedge fund poet Katie Lederer about her years in hedge fund country in the heart of the bubble and the poetry she brought out of it. Her new collection of poetry is called The Heaven Sent Leaf. She's seen both sides of the tracks in the poker world, where her brother and sister are top professional poker players. She wrote a book called Poker Face. Also in the literary world, went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, graduate there, has been editor of her own literary magazine, Explosive, and is now, having left the hedge fund world just at the end of the summer, poetry editor of Fence Magazine. You can read a couple of her poems at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins us today from Atlanta, Georgia. Jack Beatty is with us as well, and we've got lots of questions for you. Masters of the Universe, Mistresses too. Did you sell your soul in the bubble or find it? And did you know the hedge fund life, the high living, fast billions culture? Was it, when it was booming, how did it feel? What was the magic there? Was it just the money, lots of money, or something more? And can you imagine an after-hours poet at work in the land of high finance? Jack Beatty's thought a lot about money, written about it as well, Age of Money, Colossus, and more. Maybe one more question for listeners. What is your favorite passage, favorite intersection of literature and lucre from Goethe or Galbraith or Marx or Gatsby? Katie Lederer writes in The Flower of Life in her collection, "Today, from the bridge, the East River is sparkling. The money is swirling around the tall buildings like the tides or like tithes. And I wonder, does anyone swim in this river? I wonder, does anyone pray?" Katie, you told The New Yorker, you were talking with Rebecca Rothbaum there about, you know, we read about the money and the hedge funds and everything in the paper. You said it's so dry when you read it in the papers, but really it's mythic. It's Icarus. It's Faust. It's Eros and Vanitas. It's Star Wars. Wow. How so? Tell us. Take us in there. What do you mean?
Know, I hate to say this because I'm really, you know, grateful to The New Yorker for covering.
Oh, she tricked this. You into saying that?
Well, I actually said Eros and Thanatos, which I actually think is more
Thanatos,
interesting.
Thanatos, death knowless. Yes, okay.
Yeah, so it's the life instinct and the death instinct. Mm-hmm, so I think of it as very high drama. I think of what's going on in finance right now, and again, implicating everyone, implicating the consumers, the purveyors. People love it. I mean, a boom is fun, right? I mean, everyone had a great time. I mean, everyone's...
While it lasted, if you were in on
it. Right. And certainly you can make arguments that, you know, things didn't trickle down maybe as much as they should have, or in boom times certain people benefit more, and that's certainly true. But, you know, there's sort of a life instinct there and a death instinct. I mean, I think you know, this is true in so many arenas, finance, but also the environment, or even politics. You know, we all love our drama.
Did you get caught up in that? I mean, you weren't a stranger. You know, Dad's an English teacher, but you know poker. In you
yes.
come, but you came out of the literary world. I mean, did you feel that thrum, that this sort of dynamic? Did it get you going? Were you
oh,
happy
absolutely.
To leave the office, or was it magnetic?
I mean, the office was interesting, too. I think it was certainly really thrilling. And again, you know, no disrespect to people who've been having problems because of current economic situation, but it was thrilling to be in a high-rise in Midtown Manhattan during a boom, you know, a financial boom. The energy is phenomenal, very similar to a poker tournament or the vibe you'd get in a casino, right? People love to go to Vegas and go in casinos, and you just get this certain energy. It's a vacation energy. It's an energy of ease, plenty. So certainly there's sort of a vibe there. And again, back to this point that I think, you know, it's very important that artists and writers sort of report from different arenas. You know, certainly like a professor or somebody maybe, you know, living in the woods or something can write wonderful poetry, and there's a drama there. Mm-hmm. But personally, I did find a lot of great sort of literary, like a lot of tropes. Definitely coming into the hedge fund, sure, the sort of prior, the thought I had before I even entered there is it's a place of evil. You know, it's a place that money is the root of all evil. And in fact, you know, that quote is that love of money is the root of all evil. But yeah, so there's definitely sort of a drama in the same way. I don't know, Lord of the Rings or something. You know, I compare Michael Milken to Gollum in that New Yorker piece. But,
right.
But Lord of the Rings, I think it's the same kind of pleasure you might get out of a story like that.
We're talking kind of epic drama here. Jack, I mean, you can read everything about money and capital, but there is that sort of mad, marvelous energy there. I mean, Schumpeter talked about creative destruction. Creative destruction is very exciting stuff when you're in the midst of it, Jack.
Yeah, if you're a mover and shaker. The trouble is that the consequences for the moved and the shaken, and I think that's what our caller in Vermont was talking about, that you know, it's clear that these very bright people were fundamentally stupid. That, as John Galbraith said, speculation buys out the available intelligence. They didn't know what these financial instruments were. They were mighty good, though, and so let's stay with them. And the result of this kind of blind casino gambling is that, you know, the people that shower when they come home from work, the people that change the bedpans and clean the floors and make the cars and so on, their pensions are now shot. Their whole retirement is down the tubes. And they didn't enjoy the frisson of the high rise. Mm-hmm. They just did their duty every day. And I often wonder here, that if only one nurse, say a nurse, someone who lives by an ethic of responsibility, had been on the boards of one of these companies and had said, wait a minute, these are people's lives and livelihoods. We have to be prudent with these investments. We can't grope in the dark. And after these will-o'-the-wisps, we have to be responsible. One nurse who lives by that ethic every day could have saved billions.
Of course, it goes to the issue, Jack, of what stupid means. You say they were fundamentally stupid. You know, millions and millions made and still being made. If they, you know, yes, not for the nurse. We had Tom Wolfe, the great novelist, on at the height of the boom. This was in mid 2007, when money was just pouring out of every waterspout in Manhattan. And he was talking about the median income of the top 26 hedge fund guys. The median, half made more, but the median was $256 million. That's a lot of moolah, and they may be stupid, but they were also, I mean, I'm reading here Michael Lewis writing recently about hedge fund managers out ahead of the investment bank, sort of getting out. You know, I guess you're assigning a full moral component to intelligence, Jack, when you call them stupid.
Well, I just follow Galbraith that, you know, yeah, they're highly intelligent, but speculation buys out intelligence. It numbs. I mean, everything I read about this says people didn't even understand what these instruments, collateralized debt instruments, all the rest, they didn't even understand what they were. Now, you can't make a business that way. You have to understand the product you're dealing with. The nurse would say, wait a minute, you have to understand the product you're dealing with. Speculation wouldn't buy out her intelligence because she lives by an ethic of responsibility, not of gambling.
And yet, a lot of business was made. Katie, what about it? What did you, fools or geniuses? What did you see?
Yeah, I was going to say two things. The first is that, you know, and again, speaking of Galbraith, there's a great literature on speculative bubbles. And we just had an internet bubble fairly recently. Michael Milken, Enron, I mean, these stories, they're bestsellers, these books. These books come out, Smartest Guys in the Room. This story happens over and over again. And certainly, yeah, the people sort of working in the Wall Street trenches, maybe, and again, I would like to differentiate also, you know, certain different companies. It's all, each company is kind of doing its own thing. But certainly, you know, maybe they're not the smartest guys in the room, or some of them are so smart and they're sort of cheating a little bit. But I think the government has a role to play in this. I think, you know, we're talking about a bubble that happened during the Bush administration. I think it's nice to talk about this nurse, but I think we could also just talk about the SEC or people who are maybe in a better position to have sort of seen some of this coming.
You know, we talk about policy, though, every day, and fair enough, and I promise you we will again, but you're the poet.
Right.
I'm wondering, you know, brilliant fools, genius. I mean, how did you think of these people? Were you in awe of the guys throwing the billions around and bringing in billions more, and still many of them doing just that?
Sure. And again, you know, I worked in a very quantitative firm. They did a particular kind of trading. You know, it wasn't Bear Stearns. It certainly wasn't one of these companies that was sort of gathering up bad mortgages, you know, like picking cotton and kind of selling them off to bigger firms. Someone said to me, I was actually down in Austin, and I was talking to someone who worked for a hedge fund down there, and he said, you know, each individual was probably acting completely rationally. It's the system that was irrational. It was a sort of a systemic problem, which is generally true of bubbles, right? Like, everyone, you know, in New York, and again, speaking of nurses, I'm sure nurses were in on this. In New York, everyone was like, I have to buy an apartment. My friend just sold their apartment, bought it for $300,000 last year and sold it for $500,000 this year. And it became a mania. You know, it was clearly a bubble, but it was systemic. It was sort of everybody seeing this happening around them and feeling like, well, this must be real. This must be true.
We're going to push you back to the poetry. We've got a lot of callers who want to speak with you. And here's one correspondent from the website. She says, this is Linda. She says, I think I met Katie Lederer briefly when I took over her job as an assistant to a psychiatrist in New York City before her hedge fund days. So my guess, Linda writes, my guess is that she started as a poet, writer, artist, and then decided she didn't want to starve. I have to admit, I am very envious and admiring of any artist who can figure out how not to starve. There's an angle. Let's get a call from New Britain, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Katie, just as a counterpoint to that previous caller, I'd like to note that that I think your talents are being put to better use now. I have no reservations whatsoever about listening to you, because it's great to see someone who is in a position to pursue their art. But that leads me to wonder, you know, the world of the hedge fund is, you know, the gains and the losses are all so transient. It's a very temporary kind of world, and the artist's work, by contrast, is very much a quest for permanence. And I wonder how much of that sort of spiritual flow and approach guided your decision
to work there, or to write poems about it.
Some of both. To move from that transient atmosphere to sort of a quest for permanence in your art. Was that a factor in your transition?
What do you say, hedge fund poet?
For leaving the hedge fund.
Yeah, coming back to poetry.
Certainly. Yeah, I mean, certainly, well, I don't know if it would be transience or permanence, but certainly maybe the tropes. I mean, and again, I think, you know, writers can be very selfish. I think for me, you know, I was voracious when I got there. I found the place completely fascinating.
I wanted money, you told the New Yorker.
Well, you know, it's partly,
to Linda's
yeah,
point.
I mean, they quoted me that. But I certainly did. But I also just, it was incredibly liberating as someone who'd just been in the poetry world for forever. to learn about all this stuff. I mean, money makes the world go round, right? I mean, I all of a sudden felt like I understood the business section. I understood so much more about how government was operating. And so initially, the first 2 or 3 years, it was more of a selfishness of knowledge, just wanting to learn about this totally fascinating and obscure and strange world. And then I think toward the end, it was more almost an issue of boredom. Certainly, the bubble was starting to burst, I think, like sort of when Bear Stearns went under, and there was a slight feeling like I just sort of felt like sort of impending depression, or the euphoria was starting to die down. And you know, I left before things really kind of slid. But yeah, I think I just creatively it wasn't as interesting to
me. So do you feel richer in spirit now back in the poetry world, or just poorer, period?
No, I like the poet. I do relate to the poets more, and that's more my temperament. The particular hedge fund where I worked is very welcoming to artists, and they like to have people who have artistic backgrounds kind of on staff. But, you know, it is an office environment. It was Midtown Manhattan. I didn't dress, you know, it was hard for me to fit in. Certainly I'm more comfortable.
We're going to have to find out about hedge funds welcoming to artists and how that works. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Wellesley, Massachusetts. And David, you're on the air, David.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
You all are acting so ooh-la-la about a poet coming out of the financial world. I thought I ought to mention that it was two insurance men that really turned things around in the American arts during the 20th century.
Those being?
One of them was Charles Ives, the composer.
Right.
He had his own insurance agency, and he literally wrote the book on risk assessment. And that's what he was famous for during his life.
Right.
Meanwhile, writing all those...
Turned out to be a fair artist on the side.
Yes, and the other was Wallace Stevens, the poet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great poet.
Yes. So, yeah, I guess we are being ooh-la-la, having a little fun. But but Jack David reminds us that it's not as though there's a great wall between the sides of human endeavor all the time. There's just two who crossed over grandly.
Yeah, and I once read a memoir about Stevens. And in his, I think it was Connecticut General in Hartford, in his office, he had a huge desk. And he had nothing on the desk. Not a paper, not a pencil.
Wow.
The world, which is such an emblem of his poetry, which, you know, pure imagination.
Yeah.
And it was just completely. And once he was summoned to go, I think he was going to get some kind of award from the president, or it was a high literary award. And he said, no, we have an executive board meeting. I can't possibly go to that. he had to be
Boy.
Responsible to Connecticut General.
Both sides now.
Or maybe it was the Hartford. One of those insurance companies.
Yeah,
let's get another quick one before the break. Den in Hartsville, South Carolina. Den, I've just got a minute, but let us have it.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've got a question for Jack. I remember reading that essay about 20 years ago in grad school at the Breadloaf School of English in Vermont. The essay by Marx. And I remember it well, but I seem to remember that Marx ended that essay by saying that money can buy you everything except love. Kind of like the old Beatles song, maybe.
Yeah.
That's true. So I was wondering if Jack remembers Marx ending that essay with that comment.
Thanks, Dan. Jack?
Yeah, in fact, that's exactly what he says here. He says, if you love unrequitedly, that is, if your love as love does not call forth love in return, if through the vital expression of yourself as a loving person you failed to become a love person, then your love is impotent. It is a misfortune. And I guess this ends a discussion of just that, the unpurchasability of love. Isn't that interesting that he ends on that spiritualized note? But he also, I think, does such justice to the creative power of money. You know, he says it transforms loyalty into treason, love into hate, hate into love, virtue into vice, vice into virtue, servant into master, master into servant, nonsense into reason, and reason into nonsense.
And Marx into Beatles. Can't blame me, or Pink Floyd, Here's Money. Katie Lederer, please stand by. We're talking with the hedge fund poet, Katie Lederer. You can join the conversation, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Money, it's a crime. Share it fairly, but don't take a slice of my pie. Money, so they say. Is the root of all evil today?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with poet Katie Lederer about her years in hedge fund country in the heart of the bubble and writing poems after hours. She joins us today from Atlanta. Her new collection is The Heaven Sent Leaf, quoting Goethe right there from Faust. Let's get a call from Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Bob. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm an old guy. I'm retired and have been living on my portfolio and have been concerned as it shrunk.
No doubt.
And I'm also a poet. I wrote a poem called Financial Lullaby, which I shared with my financial planner, and she didn't think it helped her sleep. It was more of a nightmare. And it's just eight lines.
Let's hear it, Bob.
Okay. Rock-a-bye assets on the ticker top. When the wind blows, the market will rock. When the Dow breaks, portfolios will fall. And down will come sellers, buyers, and all.
and there we are at the bottom of the tree, Bob, at the bottom of the bush.
Yeah, you know, you have to, if you love, you can find a way to laugh at the bad stuff.
Amen to that. Bob, thanks very much for calling. Let me get another. Tony in Arlington, Massachusetts. Tony, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hi, hi Katie. Hi, Jack. Hi. I just had a very simple question, and that is, first of all, I just walked into a bank, so there might be something going on there. But my question is, I just wonder if there's one poem, or maybe two, or one poem in the entire collection that expresses some sort of deep outrage at the greed that is out there and that these hedge funds represent. And Kitty talks about blaming the consumer as well, and that's true. I mean, maybe a poem about condemning consumer society and the values that holds. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Tony. Watch your step in the bank there. Katie, I don't know what you would read in response to that. I'd be kind of interested to have you read a poem called, this is from your collection, called The Tender Wish to Buy This World. It's a little more, maybe there's a little more ambivalence. Listeners can decide, but could you set that up for us a little bit? And there's a reference in there to a pale pill. I wondered what that's about before we get to it.
Yeah, I mean, I could read that. There are a couple of other poems I don't really do. Certainly the collection's quite ambivalent. I don't want it to maybe more like a Nick Carraway in the sense it's again a reportage or a little bit of an anthropology. And again, you know, these people are human. Maybe before, you know, I read this poem, there were a couple of quotes just left over from a couple of the other callers.
Yes.
That I wanted to point to.
Sure.
So one was Stevens, you know, who said that money is a kind of poetry, you know, which is a very
Wallace Stevens, yes.
A little cryptic. And then there's Kant, who says, money represents all goods since it is conceived as a universally accepted means of commerce. It has no value in itself, which I think is interesting. And then back to Stevens, which I think is interesting, and again, this will sort of tie into the poem, I think. He says, a poem need not have a meaning, and like most things in nature, often does not have. So I think it's important, again, with this discussion, and no disrespect to people who've had problems, and I've certainly had my own financial problems with the markets going down. Money, I think of it as quite neutral, money qua money. I think when we talk about things like mortgages or, you know, people coming to you with little schemes and maybe they're more sophisticated than you and they take advantage of you, that's different. I think that's between two people or concerns certain kinds of assets. But I think money in and of itself, philosophically, is fairly neutral.
What does Wallace Stevens mean to you when he says money is a kind of poetry?
I think, you know, and we've been discussing this, money is an incredibly creative thing. I think, and this was sort of what sparked the collection in the first place, the fact that two people can come together and one person can give the other person a piece of paper and the other person can give them some food or shoes or something like that. That is phenomenally creative, I think, a creative act. And in our current environment, it's even just more amazing, right? People give you a contract, and that means $1 million. Or people give you a poker chip, and that might mean $5,000. Or you use your ATM card. You sometimes you probably don't even see all the money you're interacting with. Maybe your Vanguard's going up and down, and you don't see that money. So I think it's an incredibly creative thing and a creative act to interact with money.
Read us this poem, Kitty, The Tender Wish to Buy This World.
So this poem actually first came out of sort of post 9/11, and there was a period when everybody was going on antidepressants, at least in New York and also in Las Vegas, where I was living at the time. Mm. And I found this disturbing. It was, and again, no disrespect to people who really need these things, but this medicalization, you know, instead of confronting, and again, individually, I can understand maybe people weren't in a place to do so, but we're going in, we're going into Afghanistan, we're going into Iraq, our government's doing all sorts of things on our behalf, and people are popping pills, right, to sort of take care of their feelings.
There's also a city of money here. Let's hear it.
Yes. So this is called The Tender Wish to Buy This World. The tender wish to buy this world. The shedding of leaves from the wallet of morning. Down low by the bridge in the city of money, I will take up this axe, shatter gently this greed. We are thinking of our heartfelt need, our man, his brain dreaming atop the clean pillow. In the wallet of his soul, he files the crisp new bills of mourning, this old depression when the world will stretch a field of deep ravines. Oh, pale pill, oh, obsequious friend, to the needy and nixed, to the novitiates who play this miss and sen. Oh, smotherer, oh, plowshare, oh, savior and deranger of the senses.
Katie Lederer reading The Tender Wish to Buy This World. Tony, you may have heard some of the ambivalence at least there. Mm-hmm. Jack, Katie's there ready to take up this axe and shatter gently this greed. Are you satisfied now, Jack?
Well, you know, the paradox is that her ambivalence is our whole systems. We rely on this system to allocate capital and support entrepreneurs and create the future. And yet, at the same time, it's dangerous. It's socially, it's socially destructive, or it can be. And that's why that's here I join you with the feeling about government. People like Larry Summers and others who felt, well, we don't need to regulate this so closely. Boy, we need a cop on that beat every day, because otherwise you get what we have now.
We need a cop. We had a poet. at least one. Let's get Alex in Mooresville, Vermont. Alex, you're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah. I just wanted to add another piece of poetry to the mix by William Blake, and I won't give the whole poem, but just the beginning of it. Mm-hmm. Pity would be no more if we did not make somebody poor, and mercy no more could be if all were as happy as we. For mutual fear brings peace till selfish loves increase, and cruelty knits its snare and baits its trap with care. I thought that might be somewhat prudent. Thank
you. Mutual fear brings peace. Alex, wow, thanks. A little William Blake there. I need time to study those lines, but they come with a zing. We've got more literature flowing in here from Fort Myers, Florida. Paul, you're on the air.
Yes, how do you do? This is a little bit fraudulent because I'm only a small way into Charles Dickens, our mutual friend.
Mm-hmm.
And so, chapter 11 is Podsnappery about Mr. Podsnap, who was well-to-do and stood very high in his own opinion. Could I read just a couple of sentences from the chapter there?
Yes, please. This is Podsnap in Our Mutual Friend, Charles Dickens, read to us by Paul in Fort Myers, Florida, who's just slightly fraudulent? Well, that's okay. Off you go.
Well, because I haven't finished the book.
Okay, okay.
That would make me fraudulent, yes. But the...
Dickens.
Thus happily acquainted with his own merit and importance, Mr. Podsnap settled that whatever he put behind him, he put out of existence. There was a dignified conclusiveness, not to add a grand convenience, in this way of getting rid of disagreeables, which had done much toward establishing Mr. Podsnap in his lofty place in Mr. Podsnap's satisfaction. I don't want to know about it. I don't choose to discuss it. I don't admit it. Mr. Podsnap had even acquired a peculiar flourish with his right arm in often clearing the world of its most difficult problems by sweeping them behind him and consequently sheer away with those words and a flushed face, for they affronted him. But that's all I guess I should read.
I love it, Paul. And, you know, through Dickens, And I guess London, you in a way take us right back to New York. I mean, that's how we sort of picture masters of the universe up in those towers, moving billions and with a grand sweep of the arm, sort of sweeping, at least in their own mind's eye, the world's problems away. Was there that grand Mr. Podsnap self-sensibility among your colleagues, Katie?
No. And, you know, again, I'm going to distinguish between this area of quantitative finance, which tends to be these kind of geeky, very in their head people who are managing spreadsheets, doing a lot of like risk models and things like this. And in fact, I would say it's almost the opposite. I think if someone wrote a really good novel about these people, they're kind of a new breed. I mean, there really was this paradigmatic shift kind of right around Liar's Poker, actually. The publication of Liar's Poker thing started to shift maybe 1988, roughly, where you started getting what they call program trading, or you started getting people who could take mathematical models, model in market events, trade without even necessarily knowing what they were trading. And that's what quantitative trading firms do. They're kind of, one person says, they're kind of picking up the nickels in front of a steamroller.
It sounds like that could only be poetry
small.
To a mathematician. We've got Ashley Burnham on the website reminding us of this. She says, don't forget, while on the subject of financial poets, that T.S. Eliot worked for Lloyd's Bank. Ezra Pound felt the bank work subtracted from Eliot's artistic efforts. He campaigned for donations, I think, within the arts community to liberate Mr. Eliot from the bank and so free his creative energy. Hemingway sarcastically, of course, commented upon this in print, though I forget which book, maybe someone knows, but what a wonderful reference. Thank you, Ashley. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Southampton, New York, and Leroy. Leroy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Leroy. Poet, builder, carpenter.
Wonderful.
I like to refer to the busy few. These people who their whole focus in life is to make money and the power that it brings. It's sort of I want to say I know I can understand they may have creative ways of making money, but there's sort of a lack of creativity to me in my mind about and the sort of the flush, that sense of that when you do make a lot of money. And if I might just quote a 30-year-old two-line poem.
Yes, please, Leroy.
Yeah. The American businessman says we must build. To towering heights we climb emptiness. I just wonder how much happiness does money really bring you and things, you know?
The Busy Few from our carpenter poet. Thank you very much, Leroy. Jack?
Yeah, you know, that phrase, the Busy Few, was used by Andrew Jackson to describe the people who get favors from government. The you know, most of us rest, but the busy few are always working on government to get favors. For example, those 25 hedge fund families who, if they paid taxes at the same rate as the nurses and steel workers, the Treasury would have $20 billion more. But, of course, they buy out the congressmen and senators, and they don't have to pay taxes. So the busy few protect themselves.
Busy. David in Boston, you're on the air, David.
Hey, I want to turn the issue over to publishing a little bit in poetry and economics. I've been a fan of Kitty's for a long time, since way back when she was editing Explosive Magazine. I have all of the issues. I think you might have sent me the first issue gratis because we had mutual friends and I subscribed for a little lifetime of the magazine.
I still owe you one. I guess I made the last one.
Anyway, so, you know, the Poetry Magazine now is flush with money from the Lilly Endowment.
Yes.
Explosive, on the other end, looked like something. It was the freshest thing to come out of Iowa City in forever, and it looked like something that you had snuck into the writing program copy room after hours and basically put it together on the fly. But every issue of Explosive, it seemed to me, had more interesting poetry than a year's worth of Poetry Magazine with all of its money. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that kind of the renegade publishing model, I suppose, of Explosive is something that still provides life to poetry outside of the sort of standard economy.
David, our time is so short. Let me ask Katie, are you back to renegade publishing, Katie? Back to life on a shoestring?
I work for this magazine called Fence, which is mm-hmm. Perfect Bound. It's not quite so renegade looking, mm-hmm. but it still sort of tends to focus on younger emerging writers. And certainly, again, you know, this sort of money, I think of money, again, as the water around, you know, around a fish. You know, it's sort of hard to see. It's kind of part and parcel of every moment. And but I do think it sometimes has a little bit of a stultifying effect, or almost an embalming effect, right? And I think actually discussing sort of the themes that have come up throughout the show, too much of anything is corrupting, right? Too much power, too much money. It makes you more yourself. And that was actually a discussion that people would have in financial circles a lot, sort of after hours. It makes you more yourself. So again, like Gollum, if you're already kind of corrupt, or you're already, I don't know, louche or something, or an alcoholic or something, it sort of makes you more yourself. And that can be a problem. And I think back to this poetry magazine, I think partly poetry magazine just became more itself with all that money.
Let's quote you, Katie Lederer, from one of your poems in The Heaven Sent Leaf. These poets speak of capital as if they had the least idea. I ask you, what do poets know of capital? Across mm-hmm. this harp, their fingers play a Nietzschean revival. I envy them their will to power. mm-hmm. Jack, the last word may go to you. What do you see out there, Jack? Poetry and big dough?
Well, you know, Auden said poetry makes nothing happen, and money makes the world go round. So I guess that's the but I'll stay with the people who make nothing happen, and I'll stay with Shelley, who said that poets, not financiers, are the unacknowledged legislators of mankind.
Katie Lederer's new collection of poetry is The Heaven Sent Leaf. Katie, we'll be interested where you land next. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you.
We'll go out with You Know Who. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks, Jack.
Bye. Thank you.